From the Sky News Centre at 5, relatives of the victims of the Yorkshire Ripper have welcomed a High Court judge's ruling that he must never be set free. Peter Sutcliffe is serving 20 life sentences for murdering 13 women and attempting to murder 7 others. Former Conservative MP Julie Kirkbride was at school with one of Sutcliffe's victims.
I was really glad that the judge today referred to the fact that he did terrorise a whole generation of young women who were in West Yorkshire, living in West Yorkshire at the time. We were all terrified.
Campaigners and politicians have criticised the leniency of fines imposed on the companies responsible for the Buntsfield oil depot explosion. 5 firms have been ordered to pay almost £10 million in combined fines and costs. The blast in Hertfordshire in 2005 was the largest in peacetime Europe. Howard Davidson is from the Environment Agency.
Had the companies that are guilty today done what they said they were going to do, this incident wouldn't have happened. Sites like this can be operated safely so long as the companies do what they're supposed to do in running and managing these sites.
A Tory peer has resigned the Conservative Party whip following the announcement he's going to be prosecuted over his parliamentary expenses. Lord Taylor of Warwick is accused of 6 charges of false accounting. President Obama says the temporary cap which has stopped oil leaking from a well in the Gulf of Mexico is good news, but he says there's still more work to do. There's a new threat of disruption for air passengers. Unite has announced it's balloting 6,000 members for strike action at BAA's 6 UK airports, including Heathrow, in a row over pay. Meanwhile, the first ever national ballot for industrial action at food giant Nestlé is to be held, also in a row over pay. In golf, Northern Ireland's Rory McIlroy's lost ground on the leader at the Open. He's dropped a shot to fall further behind clubhouse leader Lewis Oosthuizen, who's on 12 under par. That's the latest. I'm Sasha Twining.
Bristol Community FM, 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
If drink is costing you more than money, then help is just a phone call away.
Ring Alcoholics Anonymous on 0117 926 5520.
The telephones are manned 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, by volunteers who are recovering alcoholics.
So they know what the illness feels like, the loneliness, the despair.
All help is free and confidential.
So if you'd like further information, then please contact us
on 0117 926 5520.
Or you can find us in your local telephone directory.
www.alcoholics-anonymous.org.uk.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Well, it's lovely to see that Red is over her cold and back in fine bickering form again. Now it's Friday drive time. Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and my guests to review this week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Labour City Councillor for Hillfields, Martin Golding. After the 6 o'clock news, well, it's like a three-part hypnotic mantra. The deficit is too big, we must have cuts. There is no alternative. But according to Ben Dyson and Ben Curtis, that's just propaganda. These two young economics graduates believe the roots of our present financial crisis are to be found in understanding who is allowed to create new money and how, and that our money system itself needs a major overhaul. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Temperatures this weekend, highs of 17 degrees Celsius. Generally a cloudy weekend with some sunny spells on Saturday morning. Next week, highs of 22 degrees, although midweek a bit cooler and fairly dry. It'll be a fairly dry week with some sunny spells, rain on Tuesday morning. Next weekend, that's the 24th and 25th of July, highs of 22 degrees Celsius, sunny spells on Saturday, wetter and cooler on Sunday. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from MetCheck.com. Well, time to introduce this week's guests now, and with me is Labour City Councillor for Hillfields, Martin Golding. Hello, Martin, and welcome to Drive Time. Now, what's your background?
Well, I'm a Bristol lad, brought up in Stockwood,
So went to the local schools up there, Waycroft and Brislington. So I've pretty much always lived in Bristol, apart from 3 years away at university in Birmingham.
And now what about your day job now? Because obviously most councillors do have day jobs.
Most definitely. You need that to pay the bills, Tony. So
Don't you get paid as well as a councillor, though?
We do, yeah, absolutely. We get paid £11,000 per year as a tithe. But also, I've got a family with two children, and so £11,000 would be quite tough to manage the household. So I also work as an account director for a communications firm called Verizon Business.
And what do they do?
Well, they're like BT, but on the eastern seaboard in the US. So I work in the international arm of that.
And what are you actually doing day to day when you say you're an account exec?
Well, effectively, I have a number of clients, Time Warner, Hearst magazines, and it's my responsibility to ensure that we're providing the correct communication solutions to allow them to do business.
Now, what do you mean by a communication solution? Because this is starting with a little bit jargon.
Yeah, you'll have to forgive me for that. So it's almost like the internet on acid. So a big corporation needs to communicate internally. It needs to share the same systems. So you'll have human resources will use something called SAP, so they can monitor what their staff are doing, allow their staff to understand their role within the organisation if they need to look things up. It's a whole slew of different things, but it's effectively what you would use your home computer for, but expanded out on a thousandfold to help run a large organisation.
Now, this SAP, is it anything to do with the same system that the police have been moaning about over the last 6 months or so that they've had as part of their IBM tie-up?
Yes, it will be. Luckily, we're...
What does it stand for, SAP?
I believe that's the name of the German company.
Oh, okay.
So, don't ask me.
It doesn't actually stand for anything. It's just the name
probably
of the company.
Probably not. Yeah. Something in German, I suspect.
Okay. How does it work, this system? I mean, how will people be interacting with it day to day?
Well, effectively, we do not sell that kind of software. What we're providing is the architecture which allows that system to run. So if you think about it...
So is that hardware? Is that computer hardware or what?
No, the cables which actually join all that up. So effectively the network. So if you want to look at it from a suburban perspective, we provide the roads and the lampposts effectively. And how you use that and put your infrastructure around it is pretty much up to you.
Okay, now as a councillor, what committees are you on?
I sit upon the Oversight Scrutiny Management, Scrutiny Commission.
Okay, because that's one of the things I always puzzle about Bristol City Council. I'm not sure if it's the same in other parts of the country, is that the chairs of the scrutiny committees are quite often Lib Dems, even though the Lib Dems are actually in power. So, you know, you would have thought that the chairs of the scrutiny committees would be either Conservative, Green or Labour.
Well, you would have thought that, wouldn't you? However, it is after the AGM. The three parties or four parties, or you can't count the Greens as a party because it's only one of them, so you need two to form a group. They sit down, they negotiate between them who will be the chair of which scrutiny commission. And you'd have thought for equity's sake and for also looking and scrutinising the council that you would have Labour and Conservative chairs of scrutiny commissions. However, Liberal Democrats have their right to electorally. They've got the majority of councils at the moment, so it's within their power to take on all those chairs.
Now, it seems a bit mean on the Greens if they've only got one councillor to say, oh, well, you're not about to be involved in this. And if they get one more councillor, that will make a difference. It
would, yeah, then they're regarded as a group. Again, it's all about proportionality. So there'll only be 2 out of 70, so that only gives them a small percentage. So if there's a particular interest or a particular sub-scrutiny commission, I know Charlie Bolton, when he was a councillor, was heavily involved in sustainable transport, which I work with him on, then yeah, absolutely. We run a broad shop at the council, and I think everybody's opinion is highly valued.
Do you think there's any chance of, say, one of the Lib Dems or one of the Labour group defecting to the Greens?
No.
Okay. And what about the cabinet system? How have you found that works or doesn't work?
I find it too arbitrary, to be quite honest with you. I believe the committee system we used to have was far better for consensual politics. So I'll cite an example which pretty much really drove me into local action was the Hillfield swimming pool closure in 2005, or Speedwell pool, I should say. It's within my ward of Hillfield. The Liberal Democrats are running a minority organisation, and the way the cabinet system works is if at the AGM the leader of the Liberal Democrats are voted in, which Barbara Jack was at that time, I believe she was the leader, they set the cabinet and they take all the decisions, and full council has no influence over that. So when the Speedwell pool came up, full council voted against that, Labour and Conservatives voted it down, Liberal Democrats went down and closed the pool anyway. So that's why I do not like the cabinet system. It's unaccountable to a certain extent.
Doesn't sound very democratic. Why was it changed, do you think?
I believe it was changed to more...
By, let's say, a Labour government, and you are a Labour councillor.
Well, I am. We can't get everything right all the time, can you? And I believe it was done to give more leadership by a cabinet. So there are some good things about it. They are the sole people responsible for the leadership of the council. So if there are things askew, then there is one door to go knocking at.
Now, here, as usual, is Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Martin, news this week from The Independent on Wednesday that because of the PFIs, that's the public finance initiatives, things like hospitals and schools, and also public sector pensions, our government's liabilities are actually $3 trillion, not $900 billion. That's about three, or more than three times as big as we first thought. Do you think this is true? And if so, how and why, you know, why is it that we've been being told that it's only $900 billion when actually it looks like it's more than three times that, the liabilities?
Well, I looked at the article, Tony, and you'll notice, in actual fact, you mentioned public sector pensions. What was the other thing you mentioned?
The PFIs, public finance initiatives.
Yes. Yeah. The biggest chunk of this money that's been referred to in the article is actually the bailout of the banks, which is in the trillions, not the billions. And when we're talking about public sector pensions being funded, we're talking about leading into what wasn't clear from the article, how many years ahead we're talking. And of course, that's an infinite number if we're talking an infinite number of years ahead. I've got a poster here from the National Union of Teachers about the spending situation facing the country. It says why there's no need to slash spending, and as teachers are quite good at sort of presenting information, I thought I'd bring it in. Sadly, we're on radio, so people can't see it. But on the question of public sector pensions, it says here $4.1 billion is the cost per year of public sector pensions for 5 million workers. But there is $10 billion, which is the cost per year of tax relief on private pensions for the richest 1% of the population.
So what does that mean?
Well, what that means effectively is that we talk about how much the government owes, but a lot of what the government actually owes at the moment is through bailing out the banking system, which has preserved the wealth of the wealthy classes. Most people actually are in debt, so they don't actually have anything to lose in a banking collapse. They do. And they're the people who've been bailed out. And
so are you suggesting that the government should have just allowed the banks to collapse without bailing
out? I don't believe in the in complete free market solution, although there are some rational and quite sort of sensible free market economists who would argue exactly that, that you should let the banks collapse. I don't think that's realistic. But once you've actually rescued the banks, you've got to recognise that you're not in the same ballgame as you were before you rescued them, and we've got to actually run them, ultimately, as a public service. That doesn't mean that we're going to make private banking completely illegal, but you're going to make it very much more difficult for people to get into that game, and you're going to have a very strong, dominant public sector within the banking system. And you've seen this in the United States, in North Dakota. The Bank of North Dakota was founded after the crash of 1907, and it's been run by the state of North Dakota ever since, and in fact has become a dominant financial actor within the state. And that's one of the reasons why private banks don't like the idea of state-run banks, because they tend to dominate. They're bigger, they're stronger, they squeeze out the private sector. But we need to get a balance back into this between the public interest and the right to make private profits.
So do you think that this headline on Wednesday's front page of The Independent is true, that actually the liabilities are three times more than we first...
It all depends on how you measure these things, doesn't it? And of course, we've had a national debt since the Napoleonic Wars, and we haven't disappeared beneath the waves.
But it's never been $3 trillion before.
No, but however big your debt is, however big it is, and don't forget that a large chunk of that is through bailing out the banks, however big your debt is, you are not going to pay it back by cutting public expenditure, because public expenditure is what underpins your economy and the economic growth in the economy. This is an old truth which has been forgotten in the last generation. And in actual fact, the public sector is the lead sector in a crisis like this. The public sector has to catch the ball, run with it, make sure that we've got the economy running to maximum or optimal capacity, and then the private sector can get into the game. If you think the private sector are going to rescue us out of this mess that we're in now, which is essentially what the government and lots of governments are banking on, I can't see how that's going to work. The private sector is itself bankrupt, and everybody's in debt. They are not going to rescue us.
Martin, Labour councillor Martin Golding. Martin, what are your thoughts on this potential fact that we're being told here by The Independent, that actually the deficit is three times bigger than we first thought it was? Surely the Conservatives are really doing the right thing by nipping this in the bud, aren't they?
I'm reminded of a phrase, lies, damn lies and statistics. It's like Martin was saying, it's what you're using as your baseline. And if you're looking at ad infinitum, what our pension liability is going to be in the future, how much we've had to invest in the banks to keep them afloat. And effectively, if you did let the banks go down, if Gordon Brown hadn't acted as strongly as he did, then we would be in an absolute bloodbath as it stands now. So I think that the right things have been done so far. I think what worries me about the Tories is the zealotry, the relish, the sort of political lines they are taking on this, to use this as an opportunity to really cut back the state. And they're not following Keynesian economics. We're not out of this. We're growing, we're in recovery, but it's weak, and I think we're in great danger with a double dip recession. So I think the Tory Liberal Democrat approach to this is wholly wrong at this stage. They're going at it too hard, too fast.
Now, we keep hearing this phrase Keynesian economics. Martin, can you just explain what makes Keynesian economics different to what's going on at the moment?
Well, Keynes was a famous economist in the 30s, and he was one of the economists. He wasn't the only one, but he was a major one who made the argument that the state was responsible for dealing with the problems created by the business cycle, by recessions, booms and depressions, and that the state has to step in to regulate the economy and to regulate the level of spending in the economy by spending itself. And of course, that was heretical view. That was a heretical view at the time, because everybody at the time thought, no, free market must be allowed to reign. If you're going to have a crash, let everything crash, and then it'll all magically regenerate itself. What Keynes showed, that there is no natural equilibrium for the economy. It can be at any level of equilibrium, and it doesn't necessarily rescue itself. What rescued the world economy from the last depression was World War II and Keynesian policies adopted by the United States of America. Now, what's happened this time is that the Keynesian stimulus has been put in, but it's been put into the private banks. And the private banks haven't passed that stimulus on to the main economy. And I think that was a mistake. Once we put the money into the banks to rescue them, we should have actually nationalised them properly and then insisted that they did lend on. Private banks are not going to lend on because they'd be foolish to do so. They're profit-taking institutions, and they're not going to make any money on it. Now, we've got to actually be much more radical about tackling the banks, but the problem we've got there is the political will doesn't really exist, and that's partly because the banks have enormous political power. In the United States of America, the major contributors to the Obama election campaign and to the Republicans were Wall Street insiders, money center banks and hedge funds. And they basically have a veto over policy.
But that's in the US, Martin. That's not in Britain.
Really? You look at what's happening with what the Condem government are doing. They seem to be very much in the pocket of the City of London. Vince Cable, who I've had some respect for, came out a couple of weeks ago and said, we must rebalance the economy in favour of the private sector. Now, that is very much from the free market playbook, but it's just wrong. Everybody hopes they're going to export their way out of this crisis by exporting to everybody else. It's like the idea that we're all going to take in each other's washing. It simply isn't going to work. We need a public sector new deal to restart private capitalism. And until we get the politics that starts talking like that, it's not going to happen. And it won't happen until we're basically gone further into the crisis. Then and only then will ordinary people wake up to the necessary steps that are going to have to be taken.
Right, well, first story this week is, we cannot allow the end of the NHS in all but name. This is in The Guardian by Seamus Milne on Wednesday. Under the banner of liberating the NHS, the Health Secretary Andrew Lansley this week unveiled a programme of dramatic change, promising to free the English Health Service from bureaucracy, put family doctors in the driving seat and hand power to patients. What could be more appealing to a workforce and users fed up with bureaucratic directives and corporate managerialism? In reality, though, Lansley's health white paper opens the door to the comprehensive privatisation of healthcare and the end of the NHS as a national service. Now, Martin Golding, what are your thoughts on this story? And do you think it's true this is actually a privatisation going on here?
Pretty much, absolutely. Yes, I think if you want to dismantle any organisation, first of all, you cut off its head. And what the Condem government are talking about is getting rid of PCTs. Now, these
are primary care trusts.
Exactly. So they go. They offer a lot of strategic direction. They have the sort of a higher up view of, okay, what do we need where? Now, if you remove that and then you go down to individual GPs, then they are going to be looking after themselves, and there's not really going to be much direction, strategy of making sure that there is cover on all the complex areas which the NHS provide the nation cover for. In addition of that, Their budgets will devolve to GPs, and you're going to find a lot of private sector companies rubbing their hands with glee, going to these general practitioners and saying, we can do this for you better, cheaper, etc. But in effect, what you will find is that the NHS will be shattered as it is now.
But isn't it actually quite positive to have private companies coming in if they can do these things better and cheaper?
I think that's a misnomer. I think you need to keep the NHS as a contiguous body in one piece. If you shatter it, it's going to be NHS in name only. It's just going to be a brand. It's not going to be an effective organisation it is today.
Martin, what are your thoughts? Because is this really privatisation by the back door? Because this wasn't in the Conservative Party or the Liberal Party's manifesto. I don't think.
No, it wasn't. And what they're doing is a kind of shock and awe. Because they've now got their hands on the sweetie shop, they're going to do whatever they want. And this was not in their manifesto, and it's not actually anything that was discussed before the election by anybody. But of course, that just tends to make people realise that what's happening with our democracy is that decisions are taken in private by powerful cabals, and then the political process just becomes a kind of ratification of what's already been decided somewhere else. This has all been decided in Washington, I'm quite sure. And of course, this allows the US healthcare companies, which are taking a beating politically in the US, to get their finger into our pie. And coming back to what Martin Golding was saying about the coverage of the NHS, there is a case for planning things, for having a plan of what you're doing.
But isn't that what the Conservatives are doing?
No, they're saying, let's have a market where GPs will compete with it, and this will lower costs, etc., etc., etc. Now, in actual fact, what we showed in World War II, and that the NHS was very much a product of World War II, is that when you want something to really work and work for everybody across the spectrum, then you do actually have to do a bit of top-down planning. I'm sick of hearing people say, oh, top-down planning, centralisation, bad. No, top-down planning, having some idea of what you want to do and setting off to do it, all big companies have that. Governments need them as well.
Well, most people listening, I'm sure, would think that the top-down planning that's been coming from government over the last 5, 6, 7, 8 years, maybe even longer, has been a disaster.
There wasn't any top-down planning. That's the problem. I mean, what we've done is we've allowed the market to invade all sorts of areas of life where it shouldn't be, which shouldn't be allowed to take to operate. And then, of course, the market messes up, and then the people running the market turn around and say, "Oh, we've messed up. Will you bail us out now?" That's what happens with NHSs, with banks, with railways, with all sorts of other things. And that was the case for public ownership of these institutions in the first place, and people have forgotten it. But of course, if you think back to the days before the National Health Service in this country, or like the United States today, where millions of people have no healthcare and their unemployment benefits are being cut off, you think about living in that kind of society where people with guns live around the corner. Great fun.
Now, this time last week, the final showdown between former bouncer, police informer and murderer Raoul Moat and Northumbria Police was just about to begin. 7 hours later, Raoul Moat was dead. It remains unclear whether he killed himself or whether he died because of the police's use of 2 electric taser shotguns, which were not approved by the Home Office. Tasers pump tens of thousands of volts into the target's body, and similar electric shock devices are used in torture chambers and in abattoirs to stun cattle before they're killed. Raoul Moat's brother Angus tried desperately to help last Friday night, but was blocked by Northumbria Police. Angus, who we're going to hear from now, was particularly scathing about Sky Television's live TV coverage of the standoff.
I was getting pretty frantic. I thought, well, I need to move now, I need to move quickly. I don't remember exactly what time it was, but I thought, well, I need to contact the police. So I got straight onto the phone and tried to ring them and say, look, this is my brother, I'm Raoul Moat's brother. Can you get somebody around here? I need to speak to somebody now, I need to get up there. I tried a few times, didn't get any response, didn't get any callbacks. So I hailed down a police car that was driving past where I was staying at the time with 2 police officers in it, frantically trying to establish my identity with them. At first they were rather sceptical, they thought I was possibly a hoaxer, somebody who was just trying to pretend to be Raoul's brother. I asked me a few family questions, you know, a bit of background to sort of ascertain who I was. Some of the things didn't check out with them, even though they were absolutely true, and they told me that they didn't have any connection on their records between myself and my brother, which I thought was absolutely crazy. What I was saying was that I wanted to go up to the cordon in Rothbury, and I wanted to help talk my brother down. The preoccupation of his conversation with the negotiators was the fact that he believed he didn't have any family who cared about him in the world. If I'd known that, that would have been even more pertinent. But at the time, I thought, because I was his brother, I could go up there and I could try and talk him down without any further bloodshed and placate the situation. I thought I had a very strong chance of being able to bring him down. I'm absolutely certain he would not have done anything to me. I would have been happy to walk up there without even any body armour. I mean, they wouldn't allow me to do that, but that's how strongly I felt I could do something about this. He's my brother, and I know him, and I know him from since he was born. I remember, you know, I'm the elder brother. I'm absolutely certain I'm good at speaking to people, and especially when he's my brother. You know, there wouldn't have been a communication problem there. We never fell out. We did drift apart as siblings over the last few years, but there was never, ever a falling out. I've never argued with Rob. I strongly think I could have influenced the situation positively, and I think I would have had a very, very good chance of talking him down there and ending this without any further bloodshed. The way it was televised live, it was something medieval but with modern technology. It was almost like a public execution. You know, I've got to stand there in front of a TV set and watching horror as this unfolds, hoping and hoping and hoping that my brother will give himself up. And then ultimately, we all know what's happened, and that did not occur. But it's also the absolute sort of pain of being absolutely powerless to do anything, even though you've tried and tried to do something about it. Absolutely horrific, like the worst possible nightmare, but a daylight nightmare when it's happening, a real life nightmare. Although I do believe Rob was mentally ill at the time, I understand and I do agree that he would have had to have served time and a sentence. I think they should have gone to trial. I think the only way to do things in a civilised country like the United Kingdom is a trial in a court of law. This has to go through the due and correct processes. You see, the issues here are how the police handled the situation during the negotiations, whether they were handled responsibly themselves, whether or not the police decided that they wanted this outcome because it was the best one for whatever reasons. You know, perhaps they even decided that they wanted Raoul dead because that was the easiest way through and that was how they perceived this was going to end. I mean, I could suggest that maybe they deliberately put obstacles in the way between myself and my uncle and friends trying to get up there to talk to him. If there was any option available which could have talked him down without further bloodshed, then they should have explored that option. So, you know, there could have been institutional obstruction here.
Now, Martin Golding, that's quite a shocking a bit of information there from Raoul Moat's brother, Angus. What are your thoughts immediately about whether it makes sense for the police to bring family in on occasions like this?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that it's just a tragic situation all round for Raoul Moat's victims, also his family and everybody involved with the whole sorry situation. I think there's a real danger of us trying to sort of second guess the situation and what was actually going on at the ground. You know, you've got the police there who have been searching for this guy for a week. It's going to be a very fraught and tense situation. You've got people like Paul Gascoigne turning up. You've got people, other hoaxers possibly involved in this, and the police are doing their absolute best job. So,
well, let's be fair to say that Angus wasn't a hoaxer.
Oh no, absolutely, I know. But what I'm trying to put in perspective is that the police thought he may have been, and it could have been other hoaxers, which actually gives validity to the police wanting to make sure that they're doing the right thing. And I think that I know it's the Independent Police Commission is going to be looking at this, and I think it's quite dangerous to start making judgments before the full story's known.
But overall, I mean, in any kind of standoff type situation like this, maybe a suicide, potential suicide as well, do you think it makes sense to actually bring family members in, for the police to be contacting family members? Yeah. And should that be part of the process?
From a personal perspective, yeah, that makes sense to me.
Martin, what about you? What are your thoughts about whether it was right for the police to, you know, really refuse Angus the scene?
I wouldn't try to second guess what they did or didn't do. They may have made a mistake there, but I wouldn't be in a position to say so. I think you've got to. I mean, that's why we have checks and balances like the Independent Police Complaints Authority looking at. I mean, sometimes people think that the Independent Police Complaints Authority is not so independent, and that's another issue.
Well, it's the police investigating the police.
Well, it can be.
There's always bound
sometimes
to be questions over that.
Coming back to something I said earlier about the United States of America, I don't know if people have seen the film Bowling for Columbine by Mike Moore, but in that film he points out that 11,000 people of about 100 out of 100 million are killed with gunshots in the United States every year, of which 3,000 are killed by police officers. Now our society is becoming more like the United States, but hopefully not that much more.
Martin Golding, Labour councillor, what are your thoughts about the use of the taser? And in this case, there's extra questions, really, because this particular taser that they used was a high-powered one, which wasn't actually approved for use by the police, by the Home Office.
Yeah, my understanding is it was under trial at the time. And it comes, not wanting to sort of shirk the question, but again, you don't know the situation, what's going on there. If he's sort of said, right, that's it, I'm going to shoot myself, and it's getting very, very fraught. If you're the person in charge of that situation, you may think, do you know what? This is the only chance I've got of actually disabling him and allowing this to go to trial and for the due process to happen and save him from self-harming himself.
Martin, what about tasers? I mean, should the police be using them?
Well, I mean, obviously there's a question mark about whether the police should be armed with guns, whether they should be armed with tasers and so on. What we need to do, I mean, what's the phrase, you know, hard cases make bad law. We need to think about the overall rules about these things without jumping to conclusions about a particular incident. We really don't know enough about this incident. It's got to be looked at, it will be looked at, and one hopes that it will be looked at objectively. But we shouldn't be second-guessing those people looking into it.
Well, it's 5:30 now, and time to take a break from our news review to hear our guest Martin Golding's choice of music. Now, Martin, what is the song we're about to hear, and why did you choose it?
Right, OK, so the song we're going to hear is Amore by Dean Martin. So this is mine and my wife's wedding song. So, yeah, it always makes me swell want to hear this, and it's a good one for a Friday afternoon.
In Napoli, where love is king, when boy meets girl, here's what they say.
When the moon hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's amore. When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore. Bells will ring, ting-a-ling-a-ling, ting-a-ling-a-ling, and you'll sing Vita Bella. Hearts will play tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a guitarandella. When the stars make you drool, just like a pastifazool, that's amore. When you dance down the street with a clod at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore. Excuse me, but you see, back in old Napoli, that's amore.
When the world seems to shine like you've had too much wine, that's amore.
That's amore.
Bells will ring,
ding-a-ling-a-ling,
ding-a-ling-a-ling,
and you'll sing Vita Bella.
Vita Bella, Vita Bella. Hearts will play,
tippy-tippy-tay, tippy-tippy-tay, like a gay tarantella.
Lucky fella.
Like pasta, frazzle,
that's amore.
That's amore.
When you dance down the street with the cloud at your feet, you're in love. When you walk in a dream, but you know you're not dreaming, signore.
You see, back in old Napoli, that's amore. Amore, that's amore.
That was Amore by Dean Martin, chosen by today's guest, Labour City Councillor for Hillfields, Martin Golding. Now, back to our review of the week's news, and we have a special report this week from Marina Morris on has crime really reduced. Hi, Marina.
Hello. In my talk on last week's show, I discussed briefly that the prison population is rising at the time when the rate of crime, or at least reported crime, is falling. Crime statistic released yesterday shows crime. It is the lowest level since recording started in 1981. How can this apparent contradiction be true? The Justice Secretary Kenan Clark has commented further on this issue, stating that the reduction in crime are due to increased prosperity rather than putting people in prison, and suggesting that he had more to do this reduction in crime by laying the foundation of an improving economy when he was Chancellor in the 1990s than the action of the former Home Secretary, Lord Michael Howard. What Mr. Clark appears to be talking about is the concept of statistical correlation. Crime has fallen through both periods of rising and falling numbers of people in prison. He's basically saying that the falling reported crime rate is a very poor predictor of future prison numbers, and that the state of the economy is better predictor. This would imply that many people in a recession choose crime. In a better time, they live within the law, but then pressed by economical circumstances can be persuaded to step over the legal limits and frequently get caught and punished. This is an issue of potential concern, as many forecasters are predicting a continuing recession. At the same time, the government seeks to impose major financial and capacity cuts on public service, such as police and the prison service. As Home Secretary, Lord Howard could influence other factors impacting on prison numbers and should have been part of the team sharing in both the credit for the positive and the responsibility for the negative achievement of government. What are the factors which a minister responsible for part of all of the criminal justice system can seek to influence? Budgets. According to statistic.gov.uk, there was an all-time high of 167,174 full-time equivalent uniformed police officers at 31st of March 2006. This number may well have grown further since the date. A newly published report for the Police Review magazine predicted a worst-case scenario of 60,000 lost jobs by 2015 to meet budget cuts in uniformed officers, civilian staff and community support officers posts. Although Policing Minister Nick Hebert said this study was all based on assumption. That should, however, help to bring down the conviction rate. Conviction rates. Up to the day, reliable conviction rate statistics are difficult to source and even harder to interpret. However, it appears that local and national conviction rates are rising. We all, as a potential victim of crime, want to see those responsible caught, punished, and preferably reformed, and in many ways, this is a sign of success within the criminal justice system. New crimes. There have been many new crimes created by new laws passed in recent years. Sentences policies. This continues to be a source of considerable influence which politicians seek to exercise over judges. Obvious examples are the short, sharp shock, minimum sentence guidelines, although advice has also been given to seek to avoid custodial sentencing if possible, some of which has been due to the capacity of the prison sector, difficulties and delays in expanding it, and pre-existing population pressures. Perhaps this is an example of the tail wagging the dog. And finally, prison. To say that there is no correlation between prison population and rate of crime is perhaps a damning indictment of the prison system. Some people have called prisons university of crime. However, at the least, prison should restrict the ability to commit further offences while in custody.
Thanks, Marina. Now, Martin Golding, what are your thoughts about the story that's in today's Evening Post, which is saying that the crime statistics in Bristol are down 10%? Do you actually believe these statistics? Because it seems they often change the way they're measuring these crime statistics in Britain.
Yeah, no, true. Like, it brings me back to my earlier phrase, there's lies, damn lies and statistics. But I think certainly I'll speak to my ward in Hillfield. Since I came on as a councillor there in 2007, we had tremendous issues with antisocial behaviour. Now, the Labour government, which was pilloried by a lot of quarters at the time, invested a lot of money in PCSOs, and they've made a tremendous difference in my ward. We, fortunately, myself and my other Labour colleague of the time, Noreen, lobbied very hard to get additional PCSOs, which we were successful in doing. So we have four to cover our ward with two beat managers, and they do a tremendous job, and it's made a significant difference to the sort of quality of life in the area.
And wouldn't it actually also make a difference if the police weren't tied up at the station all the time with bureaucracy? Then you wouldn't have to have the PCSOs out on the beat.
Well, no, that's true. Nobody likes bureaucracy. However, you need to record things, because if you need to be held to account, if you've not written anything down, then you can pretty much do what you like. So there's always a need for it, sadly. But bureaucracy can always be cut down if you look hard enough.
So you think actually crime is going down where you are?
Yeah, absolutely.
Martin, do you believe the figures? Is crime really going down in Bristol? 10% down, we're told today in the Evening Post?
Well, I mean, one has obviously to look at how these statistics were collected and so on. But I think what is interesting and significant is that as we've had 2 years of recession, that the crime statistics do not seem to have gone up, which is slightly counterintuitive. But that may be because we've got a delayed reaction to come. As I mentioned earlier, unemployment benefits in the United States have just been cut for up to 1 million people, and that means that they're going to have no source of income. I very much doubt whether their crime statistics are going to be coming down anytime soon.
Now, we're also told in the same article that violent crime is actually up by 1%. Do you think that matters?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, there's different levels of crime, isn't there? And violent crime, and injury to your person, murder, knife attacks, guns, etc., is at the highest level. So that really does need tremendous focus. And I think potentially cutting police numbers, does anybody think that's going to help the situation? Because at the last election, I think the Tories made a real bad mistake of just saying we'll ring fence NHS monies, but we won't do that for the police, and we won't do that for teaching. Now, all this is interconnected. The Labour policy is, well, we won't ring fence the NHS, because do you know what? That is interlinked to the police. You have less police on the street. Likelihood is you're going to have more crime. Likelihood is a proportion of that is going to be violent crime, which means you're going to have more people going through your A&Es and going to need aftercare. In addition to schools, if you don't have good, strong leadership in schools, and they've cut 700 schools on their on a Building for the Future programme, primary schools in Bristol, we were promised 41 million. Is that going away? That all has a knock-on effect. So I think the condemned government have really made some crass decisions, which we're all going to feel the pain in the years to come.
Well, the Evening Post is pointing out that there's something like 27,000 recorded incidents of violent crime. What do you think? Does it matter that most crime is down, but violent crime is slightly up?
Well, obviously, it's a concern. Any crime is of concern. That's why they're called crimes, and we want to minimise them. Of course, white collar crime is something that we need to think about as well. During the savings and loan scandal of the 1980s, thousands of people were sent to prison. That doesn't seem to be happening this time. That doesn't mean that there hasn't been malfeasance at the top. There has been an awful lot. And of course, if you think about the knock-on effects of fraud in the banking system, for example, on the economy, on levels of unemployment, and then on levels of crime, that's where we need to start thinking of looking. And of course, another major factor underpinning all of this is the illegal drugs economy, which we need to look at much more radically than we have, in my view, but I won't go into that in too much detail just at the moment. But I think one of the real problems we've got to tackle as a society is violent crime amongst young people. There was a 19-year-old killed on my street last week by, looks like, other 19-year-olds. And we've got to do something culturally to reach out to these young men who are killing each other in such horrible numbers. We're not as bad as the United States yet, but you can see how it could go in that direction, where everybody carries a knife or a gun.
Councillor John Keeley is Eastern Ward for that area, has been calling for a review of policing in Stapleton Row, which he said had become a containment area where some criminal behaviour went unchallenged. Is that your experience, Martin?
Well, I drove through that area quite a lot, and I can't really talk to it because I don't live within that vicinity, and I would trust John on his opinion on that. And when an awful situation like this does happen, then you do have to review what you're doing as a policing organisation, because you don't want it to happen again. And if you're not doing something correctly, or there is something you can do, then of course you need to do it. But this all goes back to the point I'm talking about, investing in schools. Now, if you're not investing in schools and you're letting them get dilapidated like they did in the 80s, like my school wasn't painted in the terms I was there, do young people feel like they're being invested in? No. Do they feel like they're outside of the social strata which they want to be in? Yes. Does that make them disaffected? Yes. Does that mean they're going to take some wrong decisions in life? More than likely.
Now, there was a public meeting held about the murder in the Stapleton Road area, which Councillor Keeney was talking at, and he also was saying, we must tackle this once and for all. We can't have another wasted life and another needless death. And one young woman at the meeting questioned how police could stop a retaliation attack where many young Somalis do not trust the police. Now, Martin, why is it you think that that's the case?
Well, I mean, that's somebody at a meeting saying that it was the case. We can't jump to the conclusion that it is.
I mean,
the case.
She knows some Somali young Somali people who don't feel that they can confide in the police.
Well, I mean, if there are issues there that have to be dealt with, they have to be dealt with. I lived in Brixton during the riots in the 1980s, and I could see a huge gap opening up between local people, not just young people, and the police. And it's always the police's job to bridge that gap. And you know, I'm sadly, I don't think we can take a horrible event like the one we saw last week and presume that it won't happen again. These kind of things are likely to happen because of the situation that's developed over many years. Mass unemployment in the 1980s created whole cultures in inner city areas of Britain where people don't work, or at least don't work in the official economy, and they're working in the unofficial economy in many cases, but the unofficial economy is policed by these kind of incidents. And we've got to actually reach out to these young people, as Martin says. There's got to be investment in the future and in the future of our young people. They've got to feel hope. They've got to feel that it's not worth getting involved in these kind of things. And also, we've just got to get away from the culture of machismo and violence and settling your scores with a knife. We've just got to get that knocked on the head.
Martin, do you think that there's an issue here with young people just not trusting the police? And if so, why?
Well, you ask a very, very broad question, and I think there's always going to be some strata of society who do not trust the police. You know, I think that police involvement in schools, which I know there's a lot of now, is very worthwhile. And again, it's that softly, softly approach of having PCSOs. So they don't have arrest powers. I know that's been a lot of criticism, but they're not there to arrest people. What they're there to do is have a police presence in an area, build up this trust. And that can take a long time for some people. So I think it's a matter of, don't throw the baby out of the bathwater. The good things are happening, but they need to be improved upon. And that direction of travel needs to continue.
Now, on to the city's swimming pools. And the start of work on Hengrove's pool, apparently, according to the Evening Post, is great news. There have been many false dawns and many delays and unforeseen problems. But now, with the first sod cut, we can genuinely believe that this Olympic-sized pool will be built. Now, what are your thoughts about provision of swimming pools in Bristol, Martin?
Well, yeah, I have very firm views on that provision of swimming pools in Bristol, I think.
Because there was quite a big campaign, wasn't there, for example, to try and stop the closure of the pool up the Gloucester Road?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think it's a matter of making sure that there is good access for people to local pools. I welcome the Hengrove pool. It's absolutely fantastic. It's a beacon for Bristol. It's something which the Labour group in Bristol have been pushing for from its inception. So it's very much our baby, and it's been good to see that it's something which the Condemn government have come in too late to scrap. Not saying that they would have done, but you know, at least that's safe. But it does. There is a wider thing about swimming in Bristol. Now, there's a pool in my area which was closed down 5 years ago by the Liberal Democrats. They've said that they want to rebuild an East Bristol pool, dependent upon what the government give them. And fortunately, the Liberal Democrats are in government, so hopefully they're going to cut them the cheque to allow them to keep that promise. And under questioning and sort of pressure from my ward, they have identified a site at Brunel Technical College, which is within a stone's throw of where the old pool was. So my opinion, they're under moral obligation to actually rebuild the pool which they closed down. They've said they're going to do that, and hopefully they will do, and that will build on the back of this pool in Hengrove, which is great news.
But it's a bit like the libraries, isn't it? I'm sure the Lib Dems would argue that if the pools aren't being used as much as they should be, then there's no point in keeping them open.
Well, the pools are being used very well, and this brings me on to another point. Now, the Labour government pushed, and it was backed by Labour when we ran the council, free swimming for under-16s and over-65s. Now, the Liberal Democrats in Bristol have now cut that, which is going to have a knock-on effect because we subsidise the pools anyway. So for actually getting people in for free swimming, we're getting a good bang for our buck. Improve 4 times the number of elderly people are now using swimming pools than before this happened. So elderly people are actually paying high council tax, are actually getting some money back and actually getting benefit directly from the council. So I think it's heinous that the Liberal Democrats have actually cut this in Bristol, whereas Liberal Democrats in Newcastle have kept. They've seen the light and they've actually kept the swimming thing there. And it just shows you how disparate the Liberal Democrat is as a wide group. And Liberal Democrats in Bristol, in my opinion, like Tory light. You know, if you vote Liberal Democrat, you might as well vote Tory, in my opinion.
Martin Summers, are you a big swimmer? When was the last time you went to a swimming pool?
I'm afraid I used to be. In fact, I went swimming not long ago, but in a river. there you go. Well, I think these kind of infrastructures are part of a civilised life. And I think that we, you know, instead of saying we can't afford things, we actually need investment in order to kickstart the economy. So we actually need a list of things that we'd like to do. Rather than saying we can't afford this, let's have a list of things that we want to do, because and get this list together, because we're going to need a new deal to reboot the economy.
Do you think
that
means
spending money on new things that we haven't spent money on before?
But do you think that the pools are really important for public health? Because surely people can just go jogging if they want to keep fit.
No, swimming is a very, very high quality exercise, isn't it? I mean, everybody knows it's the highest quality exercise you can take, because you're exercising your whole body, not just your legs, etc. And if you think about the swimming pools like the Roman baths as a kind of centre of civic excellence and a place where people go to chat and hang out, why not everybody swimming for free? Think about that. I'm sure places in Scandinavia have probably got it already.
But Martin, we can't afford it, as we keep being told.
Ah, well, this is the problem, isn't it?
Okay, on to an international story now. And an Iranian scientist, apparently the CIA, offered him $50 million to lie about nuclear secrets. He was in captivity in the United States and he's now been returned to Iran. Apparently, according to Patrick Coburn in The Independent today, he was abducted and taken to the US by the CIA and then returned to Tehran yesterday to a hero's welcome and claimed he'd been pressurized into lying about his country's nuclear program. The guy's name is Sharam Amiri. Martin Summers, do you want to comment on this? Because this is a real tense area, isn't it? The Iranian nuclear program.
Yeah, and another thing that's happened yesterday, which people probably haven't picked up on, is there was a bomb in a mosque in the southeast of Iran, which killed quite a number of people. The bomb attack has been claimed by Jundullah, which is a Sunni-based extremist group allied to Al-Qaeda, but are now actually on our payroll. They're working for the Western intelligence services. So we've got this concerted assault going on against Iran. It's hard to unpick what's really going on in this particular incident.
But this guy was kidnapped and taken to
the US,
wasn't he?
That's what he says, okay? There are other stories out there about, you know, we shouldn't be jumping to conclusions about this. I think what is clearly going on is there is an attempt to create a confected problem of Iran, which we have got to solve. And I think that the threats that are being made to Iran are themselves, in my view, incendiary and wrong. If you go around threatening to do X, Y, and Z unless somebody does what you want, you're actually threatening a world war. And the Western powers have got to take a step back and have a big, deep breath. They're in enough trouble already in Afghanistan and Iraq. They haven't got a way out of those two wars. We don't need a third one.
Martin Golding, Labour councillor, what are your thoughts about Iran? I mean, which side do you come down on? Do you think that they're really, it's actually worthwhile, kind of, if you want, bullying them in a way into stopping their nuclear programme? Or do you think they have a right to one?
Well, I'm not a believer in nuclear proliferation.
Well, this is nuclear power anyway. Do you believe them that it's just nuclear power?
Well, they've got so many centrifuges. They've built 5,000 now. They don't need that many to start off a civil nuclear program. And they've also been offered the technology and for it to be run by friendly powers such as Russia. We will build you these nuclear power stations. Why do you want to do it yourself if it is a true need to diversify your energy needs from a country who sits on massive oil reserves? So.
Yeah, there are actually quite a lot of uranium ore reserves.
And
they
still sat on oil reserves during the time of the Shah, and they were allowed to begin building nuclear power stations because the West wanted them to build nuclear power stations at that stage.
So, ultimately, what do you think is going to happen with this whole situation, the sort of showdown, really, between the West and Iran? Do you think we're going to manage to persuade them to stop the nuclear program, and is that the right thing to do?
Yeah, no, I think so. I think what the West is doing is, some of you may say it's too robust. I think it's probably striking the right line in the fact that you have to say, look, we're on you, we're looking at you, we cannot afford you to have a nuclear capability, because that will massively destabilise the whole region.
No, it won't. It'll mean that the Israelis won't get their way, because they're the other ones with Israeli they're the ones in the Middle East with nuclear weapons. We all know they've got between 200 and 400 nuclear weapons, which they haven't signed up to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. If I was the Iranian General Staff, I would be saying to the democratically elected government of Iran, and they're just as democratically elected as the government of Afghanistan, more so possibly, that we need nuclear weapons, just like Britain needs nuclear weapons, because everybody else has got them, and we've got to deter aggression against us. Now, this is how this is how this is seen in most of the rest of the world, in Latin America, in Turkey, in China. This is the way they see it. Now, the West and the Israelis have talked themselves into the idea that they are the international community. Now, they are the ones with all the big ships and the bombs, for sure, but they are not the international community.
But surely,
there is no evidence that if this went to the UN General Assembly as opposed to the Security Council, that they would be given any kind of time of day at all. The International Atomic Energy Agency, Mohammed al-Baradei, and all these people have said there's no evidence whatsoever that they're building nuclear weapons. 16 US intelligence agencies gave a statement 18 months ago saying there's no evidence whatever. This has got shades of what happened with the run-in with Iraq, where in actual fact, in private, they were being told by people like Scott Ritter, who was an inspector, that the Iraqis had no weaponry. But they wanted them to have weaponry because they wanted to invade.
But Martin,
and there is an Israeli policy of aggression against Iran.
Martin, surely the best way to keep the peace in the Middle East is to make sure that the Iranians don't get any nuclear capabilities.
Within their rights to withdraw from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, as Israelis have done, and just develop nuclear weapons. They would be within their legal rights to do that. Now, they're not doing that. They're trying to negotiate. I think there is a definite attempt by the Western powers and the Israel to break up the regime in Iran, as we've broken up the regime in Iraq and we've broken up the regime in Afghanistan. Now, this lack of... I'm a member of the Labour Party, but I feel a lack of trust in our leadership for what happened over Iraq. So do a lot of people. And a lot of people voted Liberal because of this. And we lost a lot of support on that flank. And I think we've really got to get away from the idea that the Iranians are naughty boys to be made to sit on the naughty step. They've actually been quite constructive and cooperative in helping us in Afghanistan and Iraq, although you wouldn't think so from what we hear in the media. Now, what is this? The Israelis who are pushing policy here, and they need to be reined in. They need to be told, what about your nuclear weapons?
No, I agree with the point about Israeli nuclear weapons, but it doesn't help if you proliferate nuclear weapons. It doesn't help you you have to lose yours, we have to lose ours, etc., etc., etc. What people have, they have. What people don't have, they shouldn't have if we're talking about nuclear weapons.
Isn't that what the Non-Proliferation Treaty is all about, Martin?
Indeed, and the Iranians, there's no solid evidence to suggest that the Iranians have done any more than develop a nuclear power program with the levels at which spinning the material that they've got is nothing like the level required for a nuclear weapon. They've been inspected to bits by the IAEA, by the US intelligence services. They came out and said it, but instead of the intelligence services being allowed to say what's going on, other people are sticking their oar in and say, oh no, take no notice of the intelligence services, we know better than they did. That's how we ended up believing in WMD in Iraq, because the intelligence services were overruled by politicians.
Now, let's have a look at the Labour leadership contest, and I'd just like to, because you're both Labour Party members.
Indeed.
Martin Golding first. Who are you supporting in the Labour leadership contest and why?
No, I've still got an open mind about it at the moment, to be quite honest with you, because there's a wide range between the candidates, from Ed Balls on one side, maybe David Miliband on the other, and the people in between. So, yeah, no, it's really interesting, and luckily we're having a good long time to have this debate, and people who join the Labour Party now can still vote in September, so we're trying to be as inclusive as possible, which I think is a very important thing for us to renew the party, because we've been in power 13 years. We're not in power now, so I think we need to take this hiatus to take a look at ourselves, look at our core principles, get those in order before going back to the population and saying, look, this is why you need a Labour government, because in 2 or 3 years' time, people are going to realise what the Labour government had done over the past 13 years when they have the Condemn government ripping everything to shreds, which we've accomplished.
Now, if you had to vote today, who would you vote for?
I couldn't give you that answer, I'm afraid, Tony.
Martin, how about you? with all the various candidates.
I still haven't completely made up my mind.
Oh, come on. I want at least one of you to tell me.
I shall probably vote for Ed Miliband.
You don't have to vote for the person you say now.
No. I shall probably vote for Ed Miliband because he wasn't in power during the Iraq fiasco. What we said to Labour MPs at the time is, if you vote for war in Iraq, you will never lead our party, we will never follow you. And so that rules out David Miliband as far as I'm concerned, and Ed Balls for that matter. Now, Ed Miliband, possibly because he wasn't even in Parliament at the time, is a clean slate. And he also kicked off his campaign by saying, well, I wouldn't have gone along with that. So that's probably where my vote's going to go.
In today's Daily Mail, Peter Oborne really lets rip against David Miliband, saying that in the course of a 9-minute interview David Miliband told 6 lies about all these various things that he was to do with torture. Now, do you think really that David Miliband's association with defending the use of torture is going to be his downfall?
I don't think torture is right. In any shape or form. I think it's self-defeating. I think that what you do is you debase your civil principles in civilization, and it just shouldn't be done under any circumstances, because people are going to tell you what you want to hear in those circumstances. If I got some chap with a pair of pliers on my fingernails, yeah, I'm going to tell him I wear dresses on a Saturday night. You know, it's just not sensible.
And also, of course, if you torture people, you can actually make them say things you want them to say so that you can cover up other things that you're doing. So it actually gives you all sorts of mechanisms for bad behaviour by the security services.
Well, we're coming up now to the Sky News at 6 o'clock. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour City Councillor for Hillfields, Martin Golding. After the news, it's like a 3-part hypnotic mantra. The deficit is too big, we must have cuts, and there's no alternative. But that's just propaganda, according to Ben Dyson and Ben Curtis. Join us after the news.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.